I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Ben Lerner joins me now, the acclaimed author and poet whose debut novel, Leaving the Atocha Station, was an international hit, has just published his second novel, 1004. The book has already received outstanding notices, and I'll ask Mr. Lerner about it. In the book, the narrator has a bunch of stuff happen all at once. He's diagnosed with a potentially fatal illness, he's got huge literary success, and his best friend has asked for help in conceiving a child. The book is set in New York City, and everything seems to happen. I'll get Mr. Lerner to tell us about 1004 and talk to us about writing and more. Ben Lerner is also a professor of English at Brooklyn College. He's published 3 books of poetry and was a finalist for the National Book Award. He's been a Fulbright Scholar, a Guggenheim Fellow, and a Howard Foundation Fellow. This new book is published by McClelland and Stewart from Toronto today. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Ben Lerner. Mr. Lerner, good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So, I think it was last weekend or the weekend before, I can't remember now, I was about to watch The Third Man on Netflix. And so I started the first few minutes of it and had to turn it off because of something. Then I started your book. And you gave away the ending.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I should still watch it, right?
You should still watch it, yeah. It's a great film.
But I did find it quite, it was just like, and 2 hours after I stopped watching it, then I pick up your book and I read that in there. It was just, you know, a coincidence, you know?
It's funny, yeah.
The other movie that's discussed in the book is Back to the Future. Yeah. I have never seen that. And I'm just a little younger than you are, and I've somehow missed it.
It's impressive not to have seen it.
Really?
Everybody I know has seen it.
Yeah. So it's something one must watch?
I don't know. I mean, it's part of the power of the movie for me is just that it was so central in the consciousness of a whole generation of Americans. So I'm not sure how much I would recommend the film independently or how much I have a certain affection for it because it was so central in my psychology. But it is a really interesting movie because it's very silly on the one hand, but it's also very profound on the other. I mean, it has this weird Oedipal drama in it where Michael J. Fox has to go back in time and make sure his parents hook up so he can get born. And, it's one of those movies that's both pop culture and easy to consume, but also deals with some pretty deep existential anxieties.
Did you read first or watch movies first growing up?
Well, I guess I read first. I mean, I actually have really pretty clear memories of the, like, children's books that mm-hmm. I read, which are strangely, like, self-referential, weird books. I mean, I have a daughter now, and so a lot of my reading has been, like, Goodnight Gorilla and Goodnight Moon, and I'm kind of struck by how self-referential and, like, meta-fictive they are. So I think I read first, but movies, you know, the movies of the 80s are sometimes difficult to distinguish from my own memories of the world. They were so influential.
And do you find when you rewatch certain things, like if you rewatch Back to the Future again, that after every viewing, you get something new out of it?
That's a good question. I mean, I watched Back to the Future one more time. I'm not sure I get something new out of it so much as that now when I watch it, what I remember was how differently the world felt when I first encountered it. Yeah. I mean, this was like, you know, the 80s where there was this sense of the kind of limitless growth of the American empire and this kind of Cold War symmetry and simplicity. I mean, for a kid, basically, who had that kind of worldview. And now one watches it, it's about nostalgia for the past and not about an imagination of the future. So the movie shifts because I'm so different and America is so different that it has a totally different texture now. I'm not sure that it has, like, you know, deep secrets that are revealed through careful, repeated viewing.
Yeah, but obviously film has had an influence, say, in how you construct a narrative
Yes.
in your writing.
Yes.
And do you find that when you watch movies today, that it has, I don't know if it has the same effect, but it has some sort of effect on, say, how you view the writing process, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, movies, I think what's more immediately influential for me are less popular films and more kind of experimental video works that play with narrative and the fine line between fact and fiction, which is a concern both of a lot of contemporary novelists and a lot of contemporary documentary filmmakers and experimental filmmakers. I mean, I was recently watching, these aren't that contemporary, but the films of Chris Marker, who recently died, which are really kind of essays that also incorporate fiction and the fantastical while also making very acute political points. I think I learned a lot about how to structure prose from films, and also poetry. You know, that that editing and montage in film is not dissimilar from the way you think about the relationship between lines of poetry or sections of a novel.
Now, there's a mention in the introduction, the notices for the book so far have been outstanding. A lot of people, when writing about your book, talk about how it's structured. They talk about it being a piece of conceptual art. They throw around the word metafiction. I struggled in the introduction as to how to describe it. So perhaps for this audience, you might want to just tell us what the book is. And I know it's a very daunting question, but one of the better lines actually I saw in the reviews was that not a lot happens in the book, but everything happens in the book.
Well, I think it is a hard book to describe in the sense that it doesn't have just one simple symmetrical plot, but I mean, I actually really like your description of it. I mean, one way to think about it is that it's about a guy who gets a book advance in part to fund the fertility treatments of his best friend. And so there's a kind of mixing of, you know, the literary future, the book he's going to write, kind of money coming from the future to fund the present, and then this biological future, which is his imagination of the child. But then he's also suffering from a medical condition, and so his own biological fragility is making him unsure about the future. And then he's very aware of, like most of us, of this kind of sense of the fragility of the planet and of political systems. And so really, it's kind of a book about what it feels like to be alive in the present when the future is so unstable and up for grabs. And it's also a book about the way that fictions, you know, have real effects in our lives, like how the story we tell about the future or the past really determines the character of the present. So, you know, so there's that kind of complex of issues and surrounding the narrator, but then he's also always accumulating stories from other people who he encounters. So it becomes kind of choral. You know, it has many, many voices, which is part of what makes it difficult to describe really simply. But I think at the core is his relationship with his best friend Alex and trying to imagine being a father of some sort in this, you know, given the craziness of the world, and also imagining the future of his art, you know, but kind of literary futurity, biological futurity, all of that getting mixed together in a kind of existential swirl.
So the relationship with Alex, it's a heretofore a platonic one, is that right?
Yeah.
And then she wants to have a kid, and she asks him to be the donor.
Right.
In terms of that sort of relationship between a guy and a girl, do you think how men and women react to one another has changed a great deal in recent years?
Well, I think one profound change that we're still just kind of figuring out, right, is like the fact that sex has been so decoupled from reproduction. You know, when you see a child now, it wouldn't make sense to assume that child was conceived, you know, just by a couple having sex. There are all kinds of reproductive technologies and all kinds of alternative family structures. And so I think that's certainly changed and continues to change. And, you know, for the narrator of the novel, he's trying to imagine kind of like forms of care and companionship that aren't just about the conventional family. You know, he's very interested in this kid he tutors, or what kind of care do you provide a student if you're a teacher, and what does it mean, you know, to imagine having a kid with someone where it's not primarily a romantic relationship, but it's someone you love and respect, and how would that work? So, yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of fundamental relationships, you know, between genders or the nature of gender itself is in flux, and that enters the novel. That's part of the texture of the contemporary.
And the importance of parents in the lives of children.
Yeah,
that comes through, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, and also the, you know, because there are, they're you know, Alex's best friend's mom is dying of cancer in the book, and the narrator talks about his own relationships to kind of his parents' mortality, and there's a woman who discovers her father is not her father, and so on. So, you know, I mean, there are many different kinds of origin myths and different ways of thinking about origin. The origin of his interest in writing is described, his parents' own experiences with their parents, because those are both, you know, facts, but they're also mythologies that have a profound power on how we experience ourselves and our futures. And so that's very important in the book.
Do you think a lot of people that talk to you about the book, interviewers say, or reviewers of the book who write about it, do you think they spend a lot of time or too much time with regards to what is seemingly from your own experience?
Well, I mean, the book invites, I mean, I understand the curiosity, because the book, you know, does mix fact and fiction and involves, you know, material from my own life, and then is also really distinct in all sorts of ways. For me, you know, what's important is the effect that blurring the boundary between fact and fiction has when you read the book. That it makes, I mean, the goal is to kind of make the reader think about how porous the boundary is between fact and fiction in our own lives. You know, that there isn't like reality on the one hand and storytelling on the other, that our experience of reality is determined by the stories we tell about it. But I think like my own, like the facts of my own life are kind of not really that relevant. Like, I don't think it helps the book to know, you know, that in fact I'm married and have a child in the conventional way and that, you know, Alex is made up or whatever. Like, I think that it helps the book to have a kind of shifting boundary between fact and fiction within the book, but then I think kind of like trying to parse what's true or false in relation to my own life doesn't really add anything to that. In fact, if it resolves the boundary between fact and fiction, I think it can maybe undermine the book a little. And you know, the facts of my life aren't that. They're just not that. I don't think they'd be that interesting.
Otherwise, you'd write an autobiography or something
like that. Exactly.
Now, does the process of writing, whether it's fiction or poetry, does that clarify your own experience or help you understand, say, your own relationships to your work, to life, to other people?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I think, I don't know is the true answer. I mean, I think that there's a way in which, I think there's a way in which writing fiction lets me take, some of my own experiences kind of out of the, you know, the just of chaos and contingency, and to imagine them being given kind of significant form. I mean, I think there is a desire to shape experience through art in a way that makes it more intelligible. But I also want to get out of my experience through writing. You know, I like that I use material from my life, but I don't just want to clarify the real. I want to imagine alternative possibilities, even if they're alternatives that share some features of my life or the world as it is. So there's a weird way where I think it's both about helping me kind of understand elements of my own experience, but also helping me, you know, escape them. And poetry, you know, is a little different for me in the sense that in poetry I'm really kind of, I'm kind of like having a wrestling match with the language, like listening to the push and pull of language, and what I intend to write seems to have very little to do with it in a certain sense. You know, it's for both poetry and prose, the most important thing is what you kind of discover as you write. You know, kind of the social speaks through you. You know, forces bigger than you kind of come out through the bizarre social miracle of language.
Now, you still write poetry, obviously, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it a different sort of mindset that you have to enter when you're, say, writing a poem as opposed to writing, say, fiction?
It feels different to me, although it's kind of almost difficult to describe. I think that with poetry, I'm really kind of on the I'm paying a lot of attention to the kind of language as a thing, as a material, kind of working with it directly. And with the prose, I of course care about the quality of the language immensely, but I'm also thinking on a kind of larger scale about narrative or the subversion of narrative expectations. It's almost like it has a different, I mean, you know, one difference is that when I write poetry, the revision is kind of built in. Like, I don't write like a long poem and then revise it. I kind of can't get to the next line until I've fixed the previous line. I mean, I do revise, but it's more like the revision is built in the composition. Whereas with prose, I sometimes write prose very quickly and then spend years slowly revising it. So it's hard to describe, but it does feel like a little bit of a different medium, a little bit of a different kind of work.
And do you do like sort of the aesthetic things, like a pen to paper or the computer? Does that differ, whatever you're writing?
No, I only use the computer because I want, especially with poetry, I actually want to, you know, like if I write by hand, the line looks really different, and then I have to transfer it to the computer, and something as small as the shape of the line, if it changes, I want to have total control over that. So I want to use a word processor that lets me see as I write the closest thing to the image of, you know, the imagined finished product. And I barely write anything by hand at this point. My handwriting is like totally illegible.
Mm-hmm. And in some of the interviews that I've read you've talked about the writing process and what it's like, that it's not easy, that it is a struggle, mm-hmm. that the writer is filled with a lot of doubt, and I'm wondering, does that ever, do you think, diminish for the writer? Does a writer get over that, say?
Not for me, I don't think.
I mean, is it harder now?
That's a good question. Yeah, I don't experience it as harder or easier because I don't experience it as linear at all. You know, like the best and worst thing about writing is that, like, having written something doesn't seem to guarantee you're going to write the next thing. You know, like, it's like the experience of writing a poem is like you can write a poem and somehow you're in a position where it actually seems relatively easy and everything kind of clicks, and then having written it, you just kind of have no idea how to write the next one. You know, it's not like, you know, I have a friend who's a carpenter, and like he makes beautiful furniture, and he seems to just get better because he learns something new each time. It wouldn't make sense for him to say, "I made this beautiful table, but I have no idea how to make a table," you know, the next time. And the thing about poetry and other kinds of literature is, it's not really a stable skill set. You know, you never know what the next project is gonna feel like. So I think, you know, it's harder or easier. A moment of composition within a particular project is harder or easier, but that it doesn't go in one direction over time for me. But I don't know. Like maybe the next book will get written quickly. Maybe it'll never get written. It's kind of exciting and also distressing.
Does the commercial aspect of writing, as well as the critical aspect of writing, does that factor when you're actually writing?
No, not for me. Well, first, you know, I've been until this book, all my publications have been on small presses, mm-hmm. in which money just doesn't arise at all. And the great thing about small presses is that you're given a lot of independence because no one's trying to shape your work into a viable commodity. And I was worried, you know, because this is the first book of mine in the States that came from a larger house. I was worried that someone would say, you've got to write a certain way, or you know, change the ending, or change anything, or whatever. And I wasn't ever pressured in that way. I was just left alone to be kind of as weird as I am. So, you know, the commercial aspect of literature enters this work, you know, explicitly as kind of content and is discussed. but I've just never, I think I'm too weird of a writer to have ever been pressured to try to, you know, write the book that could sell a billion copies because it, you know, it tells a great story about wizards or whatever.
Yeah, or write a book that's more mainstream, right?
Yeah. I think I'm too weird to have ever been pressured to become more successfully mainstream. But, you know, on the other hand, these books are getting all this attention, and I'm really flattered but also baffled by it because I, you know, when I wrote my first novel, I assumed 200 poets would read it and you know, and that would be it.
Mm-hmm. How long have you lived in New York?
I've this time four and a half years, and I had lived there once before for about a year and a half.
When one reads 1004, and because New York comes across as a character in and of itself, I mean, it's,
right.
I think it's too big a city, too powerful a city, say, to not become sort of a character in anything,
right.
You know, whether it's film, television, or a book like yours. It seems like a daunting place, is it? Like, I've never been there, and I was thinking of going there in the fall for something, and just planning how to get around.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Well, it is daunting. I mean, like, the first time, yeah, I mean, it's a state of exception. Like, when you go to New York, you're in New York. It's a New York logic, you know, it's totally different than the other places.
It's not Kansas anymore.
It's not Kansas anymore, right. There's a funny way where I think New York is kind of less daunting if you live there, because you have, you know, when you're visiting, it's like where are you going to stay, and like, where are your coordinates? And once you live there, you kind of plot your routine. Manhattan can be very daunting. Brooklyn is much easier for me. But, you know, the thing about the dauntingness of it, like the craziness of the city, is it makes me feel at home. It's like the city is crazy the way I'm crazy, so I feel like I'm sane, you know? Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, when I lived in Berkeley, California, which is totally beautiful, I always thought it was like a trick. Like, I was the only neurotic one. In fact, it's full of, like, neurotic ex-New Yorkers, but I thought it was like some Garden of Eden from which I was going to be expelled as soon as somebody found out who I really was. So there's something kind of comforting about the chaos of New York, and then it's just so various. There are just so many New Yorks in New York, you know, like so many languages and so many ways of being there. So I love it, but I think it can be quite overwhelming.
So you're in Toronto today to promote 1004.
Yeah.
What's it like coming to Canada, and is the reaction different, say, than it's been in the places in the United States that you've traveled to promote the book?
You know, I don't know. I know a fair, you know, there are all these great Canadian writers right now, some of whom with them in conversation and have talked to about the book. And it's an interesting question if their reaction is different because they're Canadian or just because they're different people. And, I don't know. I'm still kind of learning about how the book reads here and how it might be similar or different. I mean, Toronto is this amazing place. Like, the diversity is so astounding, and the neighborhoods feel so intact. So I'm a really big fan of the place. And I haven't spent that much time in other parts of Canada, though. I've been in Montreal and Vancouver, which are both gorgeous. But, you know, the thing about Canada for me that's so interesting is that, like, it's enough like the United States that you kind of feel at home, but then the differences are all the more strange because there's so many similarities. You know, it's like, differences in accent, or all the slight differences stand out because, you know, because it otherwise feels so familiar. It's like a dream in which things are not exactly what you expect. But I mean, you know, it's also, there are basic things about Canada that are different than the United States that just matter immensely, like the fact that, you know, it's not full of guns in the same way, or the fact that people seem to be able to get health care here. You know, there's a lot to envy. Maybe it's an idealized image, but there's a lot to envy from the position of an American about certain features of the Canadian way of life.
Do you, Ben, understand people who don't read poetry or don't read novels, say, don't consume fiction? I mean, I ask this of someone who commits poetry on a regular basis, who teaches fiction, mm-hmm. who writes fiction himself. Like, I have friends. Yeah. And we're, as I said, we're not different in age. Who don't, like, I mean, they haven't picked up a book since high school, say.
Right.
So how do you react to people like that?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly understand it in the sense that I think, like, I mean, I think that there's a way in which just text is no longer the kind of default, you know, manner of consuming information. I mean, I think that in many ways we're a culture that's been so oriented towards the image that the book feels to certain people just more marginal of a technology. But I think it's interesting with poetry in particular. I think poetry produces not just indifference, but sometimes fear. You know, like people feel like if they don't understand a poem, it makes them very anxious.
Yeah.
When sometimes what's important is to kind of let go of the conventional concept of understanding. And I think that there's this sense sometimes that literature is a threat because if someone doesn't get it, or you know, that then they're somehow being excluded from the, you know, the human community or something. So I'm actually writing something now that's kind of about why people hate poetry, why throughout history poetry is the art form that's denounced and then defended. You know, like unlike more than any other art form, it's always being taken down and then defended as opposed to just disappearing. So that's a really good question. I know plenty of people who don't read or who only read one kind of thing. I know tons of people who don't read any contemporary poetry. And I think it's both a big kind of shift in media, and I think it's a kind of anxious response to the idea that if one reads and doesn't understand, that somehow means they lack imagination in some sense. So that's a really interesting question. I mean, I also think it's that it makes sense to be very individual in what one reads. And like, I don't read a ton of contemporary American fiction. I read more poetry, and I kind of give myself permission to move around in the centuries in what I read. So there's, you know, it's not like I've read, you know, plenty of gaps in my reading, of course. But yeah, it is an interesting fact to have, like, a, you know, like, for better or for worse, a lot of my life is organized around books, but there are people I love who don't really care much about books.
Yeah, so what has to change, do you think? Do you think it's critics themselves that write about books, that they have to do, say, a more promotional job, or is it, say, the way that it's taught in schools from the beginning?
I mean, I think there are definitely ways that literature could be taught that could avoid the idea that, like, you know, as kind of Frank O'Hara would talk about poetry, like making people read their poems the way, you know, they parents make kids eat their vegetables, you know, so that it doesn't feel like punitive and something you just do because it's in some abstract way good for you, but could also be like a source of pleasure. But at the same time, like, I think that it's important not to only measure readership quantitatively, right? Like, I think it's qualitative. Like, we don't want to get too caught up in the idea that only mass circulating books are successes. You know, like if a book of poetry has 500 readers that are really reading carefully and with attention, that's a pretty impressive community of readers in a lot of ways. And in a novel, I don't think a novel needs to have hundreds of thousands of readers or whatever, or even tens of thousands, to be a success. So I think it's important to be interested in literacy of all sorts, and certainly invested in the idea that people should feel permission and shouldn't be scared, permission to engage and shouldn't be scared of engaging serious literature. But I also think we shouldn't use, like, you know, popular cultural indexes to try to figure out how many people need to be reading. You know, you know, I don't want to be Britney Spears or whatever. Like, that's not why one why one writes. And sometimes when the emphasis is just on circulation or mass appeal or copies or how many people read, like that can be a recipe for literature that doesn't take risks. Because, you know, you don't always find existing readers. Sometimes your book has to be weird enough to produce a new kind of reader, you know?
Yeah. Ben, I've kept you longer than I said I would. Congratulations on this book. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you today. Thanks for this.
Thank you. I really like talking.
1004 is the name of the book. It's published by McClelland & Stewart. It's author Ben Lerner joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plantin.